when those are the area that I have the most room for improvement. So if you're willing to take the time and do a few things that you kind of suck at or not as good at and bring those up, you're going to see your performance on all levels go up much, much greater. And so that's when we're talking about getting the most out of speed development or jump development. It's usually one or two things that you're kind of weak at that hold kind of the key to unlocking another level of performance.
From the moment you wake up to the moment your head hits the pillow, this is the It's All Day podcast. Your home for knowledge and inspiration about fitness, nutrition, and the mentality behind what it takes to be great. All right, guys, welcome to another episode of the It's All Day podcast. We are back for round two with my good friend, Zach Woodward. Zach, welcome to the studio.
Dude, thanks for having me back. Looking forward to it.
After our last episode, we literally, our first thought was, I could have went on longer. Well, at least that was Zach's. So as soon as we said that, I was like, we need to get you back on. I'm excited for round two. For those who don't know who Zach is, Zach's getting his master's in kinesiology right now at UCF. And we are here today to talk about the principles of athletic development. So if you want to know a little bit more about Zach, go back and listen to episode one. But today, I'm here to be a little bit of a listener because this is Zach's forte. This is his stuff that he's very good at. So let's break it down into the principles. Zach, go ahead.
All right. Again, thanks for having me on. So I'm going to talk about six different principles, most of which I've learned from my good mentor of mine, Ben Patrick. So if it sounds good to you, I'll kind of just run through them all real quick, and then we can go back and go into detail a little bit more.
Perfect.
All right. So number one, got to get out of pain. So you have to be feeling pain-free if you want to develop at all athletically. Number two, we need to get stronger, but we need to get pound for pound stronger. We need to increase our relative strength. Number three, we need to do that through a full range of motion. This is one that a lot of people kind of miss. Number four, we need to do that in a balanced fashion. I don't mean balance like as in standing on one leg. I need ratios of strengths from hips to lower back to knees to ankles. Number five, we need to specifically address the foot and ankle. So you could kind of count this into balance, but I think it's important enough for athletes that it deserves its own category. And then number six, the one that really ties all of these together, is being able to do all of this on a gradient scale so that anyone can come in no matter what level they're at and kind of jump in and progress to the levels they want to go to. So if we go back to the first one, need to be pain-free. So my mentor, he has a saying that pain-free sets the gains free. And so this is not just talking about not being hurt, but it's like the little tendonitises, the little things that are going to hold you back from being able to exhibit all of the force, all of the capabilities that you want to be able to develop. So even just little nagging issues, if you're trying to sprint higher or sprint faster, or jump higher, they're going to hold you back from being able to give 100% when you go to sprint and when you go to jump. And that's going to hold you back from making gains in the long term. So the body, the brain is very, very smart. It doesn't want to hurt itself. So even if you feel like you're 90%, if you feel like it's something that you can push through, your body's going to downregulate you so that you don't hurt yourself, so that you don't go too far. So number one, we need to get to the point where we're not in pain. This is what our podcast last time we were talking a lot about. We have those three principles of getting blood flow to the area, strengthening surrounding tissue, and addressing the connective tissue itself, tendons and ligaments. So that's where we need to start if you have any issues. Like even if you're, like I said, if you're not hurt, but if you have jumper's knee, tendonitis, that sort of thing, we need to address those issues before we can go into making you faster, making you more explosive.
I agree. I think all of that stuff for soccer. I think soccer players, I'm going to talk CrossFitters. There's so many CrossFitters out there that when I first started working with them one-on-one, my first goal was, hey, we've got a lot of systematic issues going on in the body. Forget about the weight. If you can't even get the bar over your head without pain, who cares if you get it over your head with a ton of weight, with a little bit of weight? If you're still in pain, it's not enjoyable. You're not going to progress. And you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah. And we're all very guilty of that sometimes, you know, push through like little niggles, that sort of thing. Like if you're in the NBA finals and you got a hurt toe, that's one thing. But when we're trying to actually develop, we got to be able to take the time sometimes to kind of check our ego, be able to take that step back and address the little things. And if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to do it in the right way, usually you're going to clear things up faster than you anticipate.
Perfect. Number two.
Number two. So we need to get stronger. And this is where a lot of traditional strength and conditioning comes in. The strongest athlete wins most of the time. But we need to do this in a way that we're going to increase our relative strength or our pound for pound strength. If you had to guess, do you know who the strongest athlete in the world is, pound for pound?
Pound for pound.
Think about what we're talking about. Who's the most explosive athlete you can think of?
Track runner.
It's a good, you're getting warm.
Sprinter. Usain Bolt.
Usain Bolt. So he's reportedly pulled 3.9 times his body weight on like an isometric mid-thigh pull. And he's the fastest, most explosive guy in the world, right? So there's a correlation there. For most sports, the main implement that you're working with is your body. So being able to increase strength relative to your body weight is going to be the most important factor in making you faster, making you more explosive. One lift that's it's a very good representation of this is just the trap bar deadlift. 9 times out of 10, you're going to find that your strongest, most explosive athlete is going to be able to pull the most weight on the trap bar relative to their body weight. It's just two times your body weight is a pretty good minimum for someone who wants to be somewhat athletic. 2.5 is a good ratio for when you're starting to get into more like kind of college level. And being able to pull 3 times your body weight on a trap bar is something, if you want to be an elite level athlete, that's a kind of standard that you need to get to. So whether you're using that as a training tool or just kind of like a measuring device to see where you're at, that's a really good representation of pound for pound strength. Same way we talk about fighters and that sort of thing between different weight classes. So that's going to be number two.
All right. So let me ask you a question. Do you know why it is trap bar deadlifts versus a conventional deadlift that they use as their metric for like an athletic weight?
Yeah, it just has to do with where the weight's centered. So with the barbell, it's a little bit in front of you. The trap bar just is a little bit more athletic. It's a little bit more balanced. There's a little bit less technique in terms of ripping the bar up your shins and that sort of thing. And it's more so just from observing this like in the field and in practice, the trap bar just tends to correlate a lot better. The front squat's a pretty good one as well. But the trap bar just seems to be the best compared to the barbell just because of where the weight is centered.
Gotcha. Okay.
So number three. So this is the big one. This is when we start getting into full range of motion. And this is one that a lot of people miss out on. So we need to get strong. We need to improve our strength, but we need to do that through our entire range of motion. So we spent a lot of time in our last podcast talking about that in terms of knees and that sort of thing. And this is when we introduce the idea of like the strength curve, right? So a given muscle or a given joint is going to have a certain amount of strength as it goes through its entire range of motion. So if we think about the knee, when it's fully bent at the very bottom position, you've got a decent amount of strength. Right in the middle, you've got the most amount of strength. And then right at the top, you've got, again, a less strength. So you've got this kind of bell curve looking shape where you're going to get stronger in the middle, weaker at the top and bottom. Most traditional exercises are going to also train that middle position. So if you think of like a traditional squat, front squat, back squat, it's the hardest right in that kind of middle position, that kind of mid knee bend. And so if that's where it's the hardest, that's where we're going to get the greatest stimulus to adapt and get stronger. So then that middle range is going to get even stronger compared to our bottom and our top. And so over time, that's going to lead to an increasing gap between our ranges in the bottom and top positions and our ranges in the middle position. And that's going to set us up for either getting hurt because we have such a vast difference in the amount of force that we can handle and produce in different ranges of motion, or at the very least, we're going to plateau because your body is not going to let you keep getting stronger, stronger, stronger in one range without bringing up the other ones because, again, the body doesn't want to hurt itself, right? So until you can address the very bottom range, the very top range, if that bell curve gets too steep, basically, you're going to either plateau or get hurt. Like, do they need to be identical? No, you're never going to have a flat line, but you need to have a lot of balance between that. And I think that's a big one that a lot of people kind of miss out on.
Yeah. And let's talk about, I think, one of the biggest reasons why people do miss out on that one. And you can tell me if you agree on this or not, but I think a lot of it has to do with people's ego.
100%.
I think a lot of people out there do not want to have to go through the entire full range of motion, myself included. During this bodybuilding prep, I was focusing on building my biceps. I had to do preacher curls with full range of motion in LA Fitness, full of ton of dudes. And what am I grabbing? Like the first week was like 17 and a half. And I was like, I don't know. I was like, dude, do I really want to do this? Back in the day, it would have killed me. If I was in high school, I'd be like, no way, not doing it. Like half a rep, way higher weight. And nowadays I'm like, dude, I want to go all the way down. I want to stretch it out like crazy and bring it all the way back. Because that's, like you said, you're going to get the most strength gains from full range of motion versus half range of motion, you're going to get more tears in your muscle fibers if you go way, way longer and stretch it than if you don't hit that full scale, like you said.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. Like, and if we're talking about literally, if you want to go from the perspective of trying to build more muscle, trying to look good, if you work through a greater range of motion, you're going to stimulate more muscle fibers, it's going to get a greater adaptation. The other side of that too is not just taking a regular exercise like a squat or something like that and working all the way down, that's very important, but then also using different exercises that are going to target different ranges of that strength curve. So for the knees, we have at ATG, they have like four kind of main knee strengthening exercises that are all going to target different ranges. So like the ATG split squat, the split squat where you're trying to push your knee forward as far as you can, trying to touch your butt to your heel without your heel coming up too high. That's really going to develop the full bend position of the knee. If you think you did the pitcher squat where your heels are elevated a little bit and sat down where your feet are touching your feet are touching your butt, that's really going to strengthen that bottom range more so than anywhere else, just because of the leverages. And then if you think of like a traditional front squat, back squat, that's going to get our middle range. And then something like the step up is really going to develop that top end range. And then you can go even further with something like a KOT squat or a sissy squat, where you're on your toes, reaching your knees forward, trying to basically like touch the ground. And that's even farther kind of into this outer range. So it's not just working traditional exercises through a full range of motion. It's being aware of how to manipulate different exercises that are going to specifically target different ranges of motion more than other ones. So it's kind of into that bodybuilding concept as well. How many different ways can I target the biceps? Different, a concentration curl versus a preacher curl is going to be stronger, is going to be more challenging at different ranges of motion. And that's how you can develop that full range using a variety of exercises.
Yeah. I've found out when I do a hammer curl versus like a traditional curl, I've apparently never trained hammer curls because I did those and they destroyed me, because it was just the way I didn't hit it before.
Yeah.
And why do you think so many, I think because it's such a full range of motion that people are afraid of that full range of motion. Like, I'm going to get hurt because I'm going so far. I'm not used to it. What do you tell somebody who has that fear of going into a full range of motion?
Yeah, that's definitely very normal. Some of the things that I'll post like on my Instagram, I've gotten to a decently high level in terms of like seated good morning, I can do my body weight on my back. And if you just look at a picture of that, it looks somewhat intimidating. That comes down to then when we talk about like gradient scale. And so just being able to kind of with the ego thing, take the step back. All of these movements are 100% regressible to the point where with the step up example, yesterday I did a 6-inch box, Patrick step up, 100% body weight on my back for 10 reps. You can take that back to body weight with your hands supported on something for balance on a 1-inch box and just reaching your heel down just that little inch just to tap the floor and then come back up. Mm-hmm. So same exercise, but you can literally scale it somewhere down where I have my mom doing pretty much the same program that I'm doing and a lot of my athletes are doing. And it's just scaled differently so that you can jump in wherever you're at. You just have to be willing to sometimes take that step back a little bit. And like you're talking about, like getting the lighter dumbbell or whatever it is, just being willing to take a step back, do things the right way to set yourself up for longer term gains down the road.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
All right, so number four. So this one's a big one as well. This is when we talk about balance. And so this is one of the things that I think we miss in the traditional weight room settings a lot. I'm not talking about balance in terms of literally being able to balance on one leg. I'm talking about the balance between my quads and my hamstrings, between my hips and my knees, between my knees and my ankle. Because it kind of goes back to the full range of motion idea. If I'm not getting that entire strength curve balanced out, if I'm not balancing my joints in relation to one another, if my hips are super, super strong, but my ankles are super, super weak, I'm going to either, my brain's going to downregulate the amount of force that I can produce, or I'm going to get hurt. So the ankles are a big one. That's why it's a whole nother category by itself. But if you think about most of the time what we do in the gym, it's probably a 3-to-2-to-1 ratio of hips to knees to foot and ankle, if we're lucky. And a lot of times for athletes,
could you give an example of what like a 3-to-2-to-1 ratio?
So like we're going to train our hips about three times as much, like for every foot exercise that I'm going to do, or something that's going to strengthen my foot and ankle, like a calf raise, I'm going to do probably two kind of knee dominant exercise. So a front squat or a knee extension, and probably three hip dominant exercises, whether that's an RDL, a squat, a deadlift, something like that. And so the amount of time and attention that we place on the hips versus the knees versus the ankles, we're kind of skewed in the opposite direction, where a lot of times athletes are going to need almost the opposite, where like three times the amount of time on their foot and ankle as then going up to two times on their knee and one time on their hip. But just having that balance between front to back, top to bottom, side to side is another really big one. So something like the ATG split squat, why it's so powerful versus a front squat. If you can front squat well, is you're going to get imbalances from side to side, and you're going to address that when you work more unilaterally. So this even comes into when we do jump technique and sprint work, alternating which foot you start with. But jumping is a big one. So there are four different ways that you can jump, four different plants. I can jump off my left foot. I can jump off my right foot. I can jump off of a right-left plant with 2 feet, or a left-right plant with 2 feet. And most of the time, people are going to have one, maybe two, that they're very dominant off of, that they prefer to jump off of. And if you're in a jumping sport like basketball or volleyball or something like that, and you're just doing that same plant over and over and over and over again, you're going to disproportionately strengthen the muscles that are going to accelerate and decelerate on one side versus the other. And then again, that leads you to either plateau or worse, injury. So this idea of balance is about having a very, very, very wide base that allows us to stack kind of gains, like build that pyramid. The wider my base can be, the higher I can stack that in terms of athletic development.
Yeah, I think definitely, especially the fact that we're talking to athletes about this. Gen Pop people, I feel like they really got to want it if they want to go to this next level of going away from compound movements to unilateral movements to building their base, because I agree with you 100%. In CrossFit, when I did functional bodybuilding, it was all unilateral leg, unilateral arm work, and I had huge gains in the compound movements because of it, versus only doing compound movements, only squatting, only back squatting, front squatting, versus split squats, versus step-ups, all these types of things that work unilateral movements. But athletes miss this almost all the time. I don't know a lot of college athletes who ever were doing a ton of unilateral work in any setting. Well, you know UCF, were they doing stuff like this?
To a certain extent, but yeah, those two things that we really miss the most are doing unilateral work with an intent to balance out sides, rather than we're just going to do unilateral work and maybe you're weaker on one side, but that's just the way it is. And then working through that full range of motion. Those are two things that I think we miss a lot of. And yeah, like you're talking about, like from just personally training the ATG split squat and the seated good morning really, really heavy, my front squat and my trap bar deadlift numbers went way up without having trained them. And I don't know how long I pulled 450 on a trap bar deadlift without having pulled from a trap bar in at least 6 months. So the carryover, because again, a lot of this is about, if you sum all of this up, a lot of this is about developing your weakest link. And that's a really, really important thing that I think in a lot of settings we tend to avoid, especially from an athletic development side of things, whether it's in the weight room or whether it's on the field, because it's like you talked about, when I'm in the gym, I want to be able to look good in the gym too, right? I don't want to see other people. So I'm going to work on what I'm already good at. When I'm on the field, well, my coach is the one that dictates my practice time. So I want to make sure I look good in practice so that I can play in the game. So I'm only going to work to my strengths. And we tend to avoid our weaknesses when those are the area that I have the most room for improvement. So if you're willing to take the time and do a few things that you kind of suck at or not as good at and bring those up, you're going to see your performance on all levels go up much, much greater. And so that's when we're talking about getting the most out of speed development or jump development. It's usually one or two things that you're kind of weak at that hold kind of the key to unlocking another level of performance.
I remember I've tried the jump off different feet.
Yeah.
Vert test, and it is horrible for starters.
It's terrible.
And especially, I was a keeper. So when a cross came from the right side, I'm jumping off my right foot. But when a cross came from the left side, I jump off my left foot. So I'd practice it before. I'd do it in games. But having to do it in like a running setting and changing the pattern that was like ingrained in my head was ridiculous. The difference of my vert, I don't know what the number was, but it was over half.
Yeah, I was very terrible jumping off of one leg, and especially jumping off of my left leg compared to everything else. A lot of soccer is like two-footed jumping. But yeah, so if you guys are kind of listening, like a good test is just go somewhere where you have a basketball court and then go and try and jump off of all four nets or all four plants and try and just touch the rim and see, even if there's not a height difference, see how much more comfortable you feel off of one versus the other. And you're probably going to notice a big difference that you have of side that you favor a lot more than the other.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk. You said foot and ankle was like the last big piece of this.
Yep. So that's coming up next.
Perfect. Let's break it down.
Yep. So the foot and ankle, you could include that in balance in the sense that we need to address that to be balanced from top to bottom. But it's really so important that it deserves its kind of own category. So one of the biggest things when we're looking at the foot and ankle is range of motion. So range of motion at the ankle and then range of motion at the big toe. So if you think of sprinters coming out of the blocks, basically, the lower I can get my shin in relation to my ankle, the closer I can get that, the more force I'm pushing horizontal that's going to take me forward versus popping me up. So Charles Poliquin, who's one of the greatest strength coaches of all time, basically said that the athlete who can push their knee over their toe the farthest, which is ankle range of motion, how low I can get my shin, is going to win. Just because the greater range of motion I have there, the more force I'm putting in the ground is going to push me forward rather than vertical. So that's a very, very important thing. And that's why something like the ATG split squat is so powerful, because you're not only strengthening the knee in a full bend position, you're also pushing range of motion at the ankle every single rep. But then the toes, like the foot itself, is something that gets very underappreciated as well. So a good minimum is if you have your foot flexed up, you should be able to take your thumb and pull your big toe back to 70 degrees is a minimum. 90 degrees is a really good standard to get to, because the same kind of principle. If you're locked up through your toes, then your foot is going to get picked up off the ground early when you strike the ground in the gait cycle. And then again, you're going to start popping up rather than being able to push things forward. So having range of motion is a start, and then having really strong feet, really strong toes in relation to the rest of the body is really, really important. The feet in particular, because of that down regulation that we were talking about. So if your body does not trust the ability of your foot and ankle to absorb and produce force, when we run, we get up to 5 up to 7 times body weight. If you're sprinting in that kind of impulse, that millisecond that the foot's on the ground, if your brain does not have trust in your foot to be able to tolerate those forces, it's going to downregulate the glutes. They're tied to each other through fascia. So you're basically just going to not be able to produce as much force, because your body, again, doesn't want to hurt itself. So really good places to start for this are the spring ankle isometrics that Cal Dietz and Chris Corfus have talked about. So I posted one of them up on my Instagram page a couple weeks ago, but they're basically 5 different positions that are going to target different positions in the gait cycle. So one of them would be, if I was standing on the ground, leaning against a wall, facing the wall, I'm going to squat straight down until my knees are pushing forward, my hips aren't going back, until I feel a stretch in my Achilles. Then I'm going to come up on both feet as high as I can up onto my tiptoes, squeezing my calves, and then I'm going to pick one foot up. And I'm going to hold that position for 60 seconds. That's a minimum. And that's going to really, really strengthen the ability of the arches of the feet, as well as you're getting a pretty gnarly isometric in the knee. So the first time you've done this, you're going to get like a lot of shaking, but working up to 60 seconds is a really good minimum you need to be able to get to start to develop that strength of our plantar fascia and of our foot and of our ankle. And then you can start to load it and get a little bit higher. But 60 seconds is that minimum. And there are 5 different positions that are going to target different positions of the gait cycle. But spending the time to target the foot and ankle, not even just through these isometrics, but with the ATG program, they do more sets of calf work and tibialis work than they do of like squats, which is, you're not going to see a lot of programs that are doing that kind of thing. So just taking the time to develop the lower leg, develop the foot and the ankle are going to be critical to any sort of athletic development. You look at sprinters, they've got fantastic like calf development, lower leg development. Show me a really powerful, really explosive athlete who doesn't have well-defined, well-developed calves, tibs, strong feet, strong ankles.
So that last example you were talking about, that's basically like a really, really intense calf raise on your toe that you're holding.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. For 60 seconds to be able to strengthen your foot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting. That's stuff that I've never necessarily thought about before, but it all makes sense with most athletes out there. Ankles and feet are probably some of the most important things out there, because without those, you can't express any other type of athleticism, power, any of those things without really, really strong ankles and feet.
And again, when we're coming back to weakest links, like for most people, that's what they've been exposed to the least in their training.
Yeah. I mean, even now that you're saying this, I'm thinking like somebody, Gen Pop, very overweight, who has tons of inflammation in the ankle, never trained the foot, they're holding so much weight and every single step is a ton of impact in the joint, and they're trying to do some work in the gym, they're trying to squat, they're trying to do upstairs, but they're in so much pain or they're scared. Like you said, if your foot is afraid to take the step, it's going to downregulate things. So they even have a harder time making progress because they haven't addressed the foot, which is such a small thing when they're trying to just lose weight.
Yeah, and especially for when you're talking about people that are a little bit more overweight, if they don't have that strength in the foot, you're going to change your gait pattern a little bit too.
So explain also, what is a gait pattern for people who don't know?
Basically, it's just the cycle that you go through as you walk. So as your leg swings, hits the ground, you roll through your foot, and then comes back. So it's just that continuous cycle that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And there's different phases of it when you sprint. That's why there are those different spring ankle positions that are just targeting different positions. And if you're having foot ankle issues, a lot of times you're going to change the way that you're walking. So a lot of times the feet will start to spin out. You're going to start to roll to the inside edge of your foot. Your ankle kind of collapses a little bit. And then when you do this for reps and reps and reps and reps, you're changing the way your body is tolerating force as well. So you start to put a lot more stress on the knees and on the hips. This even goes back to when we were talking about the tibialis last podcast for knee pain. Just being able to strengthen the tibialis through that simple wall exercise is going to help me when my heel strikes the ground, when I walk or when I run, to be able to absorb that force so it's not just getting shot straight up into my knee.
Okay, so I walk and my left foot turns out slightly. Does that mean that I've got foot issues that I need to be addressing, or could that also be a physiological thing where I've got maybe a longer leg than the other or something like that?
It's possible you could have a physiological thing, but a lot of times that's just a way that you've developed over time. So soccer in particular, we're very imbalanced when you kick one way versus the other. And so unless you've noticed it, take the time to address it, you're probably going to have imbalances from side to side the same way you would in strength, right? So you're going to have your right leg is going to be stronger than your left, whatever it is. And it's a lot of times the same way in gait. Having that foot turned out can be an issue because then we lose a lot of the stability at the ankle. So then that ankle starts to collapse every time you take a step, and then that starts to push forces up into my knee and up into my hip.
Dude, I went so...
Get your feet straight, son.
Bro, I ran a 5K a couple months ago in Ormond. My girlfriend's like, my mom's running this 5K with my nephew. It's on the beach, like, you should run it. Like, you'll win.
On the beach too, man.
You'll win it. And I was like, I haven't ran. Like, I'm not going to win it, whatever. She's like, all right, let's just go and we'll watch it. And I was like, all right, we'll go and watch it. I go there. I see the whole thing getting set up. She's like, so, like, you should just run it. And I'm like looking around and I'm like, all right, there's not a lot of people here. I haven't ran. It's only a 5K. Like, I could probably hurt for 3 miles and it won't be that big of a deal. Run to the car, get some cash, try to sign up. I'm like $10 short. The guy signs me up anyways. I have CrossFit shoes on, so fully flat, no support.
You're not running barefoot in the sand?
I don't know. For some reason, I thought shoes were going to be better. So I wear shoes, run the whole thing. By the time I get done, my knee, my left knee, one that my toe points out, was so jacked up. It was death. It was really bad. And the fact, like, after this physique show, I told myself and I wrote my goals that I was going to run a half marathon. I don't know if I'm going to run a half marathon. Just because this physique show has been painful and I'm thinking about maybe doing a golf tournament instead. But could it have been because my ankle was turned out, so many consistent blows on the ankle radiating up to the knee that caused the pain?
Exactly, yeah. So there's two ways to address something like that. So when we look at gait, it becomes so important because, like you're talking about, over the course of a 5K, you're taking, 1,000 steps? So even if there's just like a tiny, tiny, tiny twinge or shift to one side or something that's slightly uncomfortable, over those 1,000 steps, over those 10,000 steps a day, it just becomes exacerbated. So getting your feet straight is just like a really big one in particular. Then the other side to address that is musculoskeletally. When we talk about strengthening the knee through the full range, developing the tissue, and then that basically offers you protection against that just because you have tissue that's so resilient that it's able to tolerate these kind of forces. So those are the two ways you can kind of combine to address that. But yeah, the foot thing could definitely be.
So if I need to turn my foot in, am I working some like glute work? Because I feel like when I turn my foot in, my glute is what turns on the most.
It's more of getting reps in with your foot straight. The same way that you kind of developed unconsciously to just now have it turned out a little bit. It's getting reps of different gait style exercises that are going to replicate that a little bit, but now getting your foot straight and then getting reps and reps and reps and reps to kind of unwire that old firing pattern and now get your brain, your body into unconsciously thinking like, okay, this is how I'm going to move through space.
Yeah. I'm walking right now for the physique. I've got to walk 13,000 steps every day.
Oy.
So I've actually, I've been focusing on my feet a ton, but now I've noticed, I'm like, man, I look down the entire time when I'm walking in my neighborhood. Like I probably look like the saddest kid ever. So my goal is like, all right, just look up. And like, if a car comes, like smile and just like wave to them. I get some people wave back, some people don't, but I'm like, you know what? Just like get used to it. Cause I'm sick of looking down and my shoulders start to hurt.
I gotta look up. I've noticed that too. When I started getting into a lot of the biomechanics of like walking and running is like I catch myself like looking at my feet, like trying to feel what's going on. It's like, wait, no, look up. So yeah, get your feet straight. Start walking on the ball of your fourth and fifth toe. You'll be good to go.
Sick. All right. And then, so we've done foot and ankle. And then the last one is scale. Correct?
Yeah. So this one is, I think, the most important because it ties everything together. And this is that I kind of talked about it with the example of my mom, of all of these exercises, all of these principles are 100% scalable from somebody coming out of an ACL surgery to an Olympic athlete. And it's the same principles, these same five principles, and just dialing it back, progressions and regressions, to the point where I can get somebody into one of these things. So if somebody has debilitating knee pain, can't do a squat through a full range of motion because their knee hurts, I need to find out a way to start to get blood flow to the knee, start to open that up, so then I can start to get them into that full range pain-free. And so that's where something like a backward sled, where I'm just making them drag something backwards, they're going to get a ton of blood flow to the knee. And then I start with maybe a step up where I'm just working them through a 1 to 2 inch range of motion, but I'm really targeting the VMO and I'm just getting reps, 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 getting their quads, getting their VMO on fire. And then they're super warm. They've got a ton of blood flow. Maybe that day I can't get them into a full bend. We come back the next day, we do the same thing, backward sled, step up, step ups. And now I can get them with their heels elevated, supporting on something to take a little bit of their weight off. Now they can get into a full squat with both legs. And now we can start to get into that full knee bend and start to address the tissue, the connective tissue, ligaments, and that sort of thing. And then that's how you get somebody into it. And then you just progress that. So they started with their 1 inch step up, they've started with their sled. Now we're just adding weight to the sled. Now they're moving faster. Now with their step up, we're increasing the height 4 or 5 inches, putting a bar on their back, getting to the point where you can go from that 1 inch box to a 6 inch box with 100% of your body weight on your back for 10 reps is quite a transformation. But when you take the time to go through that kind of gradient scale, just go one step at a time, one, it'll happen faster than you think. And the transformation to get from A to B is pretty powerful.
All right. So let me ask you this then. Talking athletes, high school, college, pros, let's go at least our kind of age, college type players. You've got 4 years. Your coach knows you've only got 4 years. You come in freshman year. How does coach progress you through these things while making sure that you're ready for the season in whatever sport you are? Do they focus solely on this type of stuff because some players might really need it? Do they do it sparingly? Do they do it a lot, a little? How would they do it to make sure that their players are preparing their best for season? I'm basically asking you, do you think the strength and conditioning department kind of needs to change the way they do programming to allow some of this stuff to be implemented? Because I do think it's super useful and powerful.
I think so, 100%. And I think that it's starting to happen very slowly, and the results are starting to speak for themselves. And the more that it catches on, the more I genuinely believe this is going to become the norm in strength and conditioning. And yes, I think that finding a way to implement these principles, like since I've been doing this, I've not just become healthier, I've become more athletic than I ever have been. We talked about it a little bit before. I went from running a 5:240 my freshman year in college when I was actually a college athlete to now running in the 4.6s. When you apply these principles and you're patient and do it over time, it works. So it's absolutely possible to take a freshman and develop them into a senior who's ridiculously explosive, but then also really, really resilient, really resistant to injury, which is, I think, a big thing. When we look at sports nowadays, like across the board, whatever pro sport you want to look at, injuries are the highest that they've ever been. So using these principles, again, we're widening that base. So we're making them more resilient. Remember, pain-free is the first one on the list. And that's going to let us develop more over the long term. When we're talking about, I'm glad you brought up the athlete question, like in season, because when we get into programming, personally, I'm a lot less concerned with sets and reps and periodization than I am with targets. So when I keep coming back to the step up example, the standard for that, so having a clear standard that each athlete needs to hit and then working their way to that standard rather than being that you're going to have five sets of this at this weight and go. So having that 6-inch box, 100% of my body weight on my back, 10 reps. Boom, that's a clear standard. I can see where I'm at right now, see what I need to do to work towards that. And something about that, it's almost more positive and it gives you something to...
There's an end goal in sight.
Yes, exactly. Rather than I'm going to do 5 sets of 5 of this and then kind of move on and come back next week and I'm going to do 5 sets of 5 and hopefully be at a little bit higher weight.
That was the problem, man. Every time you went to the strength and conditioning room, it was like, here's what's on the board. And we're like, why? Just do it. And yeah. Then you show up the next week and like, here's what's on the board. It's the same thing, except I changed tricep extensions to curls. I'm like, we'll play soccer. So what does that do? They're like,
yeah,
just do it.
100%.
So like, yeah, I think having an end goal for anybody is extremely important, especially I love the standards idea for athletes of having standard of where you should be, because it then becomes really easy to progressively overload, progressively like just progress towards that target versus like you said, hey, a little bit more weight. I'm not going to tell you why, just do it.
Exactly. When you're programming it too. So when we come back to the knee example of having 4 different exercises that are going to target the knees through different ranges of motion. When I go to, so actually let me back up. So one thing that I really, really like when we're talking about athletes, one thing that we have to be very careful of in the weight room is making sure that the weight room is not their sport, right? So their sport is that's going to take priority always. So using ramp sets are something that I really, really like to get a strong stimulus and really spare, like minimize the volume. So when I say a ramp set, so if we come back to that 5x5 example, so you've got 5x5 seated good morning. A regular 5x5 would be you're going to do 2 or 3 warm-up sets, you're going to put the weight that you're working on the bar, and you're going to do 5 sets with that weight. The ramp sets idea is your first working set is going to be with a barbell, and then your second working set, you're going to add 10s, and then you're going to keep doing that. And so set 4 is kind of heavy, and set 5, you're trying to get your best set that you can for that day, still making sure technique's awesome, things feel good, like we don't want grindy reps, but you want to give me your 5 best reps that you can for that day, and then boom, you're done. And then you're going to come back the next day, and so, or the next week, or whatever it is. And so we're getting that strength stimulus. So if you compare that idea of 5x5 to the first set of 5x5, the first set, maybe we're working at 60, 70% of our 1RM, whatever it is, and we're working through 5 sets of 5 there. So we're getting a lot of volume, but not really a max strength stimulus. Versus with that ramp set of 5x5, I'm starting really light. My first 4 sets, I'm grooving technique, I'm grooving that motor pattern, working on range of motion, making sure things feel really good. And then I'm getting it 1 set that's maybe a 9 out of 10, something where I really push, get that stimulus, get that neurological stimulus, hormones, that sort of thing, and then rack it, back off, move on to whatever I need to do. And what that's going to do is it's going to let me, A, get a max strength stimulus every time I come in the gym, and then more importantly, it's really going to spare my nervous system, spare like all of my energy if I'm in season, if I'm practicing, whatever it is, so that I can go and play my sport and do that sort of thing. And then when you take that and combine that with the knee example where we have 3 or 4 different exercises all targeting different ranges of motion. So say maybe I train the first 2 Monday and Friday. So I train the ATG split squat where I'm getting that full bend, and I train the step up where I'm getting that kind of top end range. And then next week I train a front squat and I train a sissy squat. And then by the time I've come back to my ATG split squat and my step up, I've had time to adapt. I've stimulated my knees, my quads through different ranges of motion. I've stimulated that max strength through my ramp sets without kind of draining myself, without using too much volume. And now when I come back, I can do an extra rep than I did the week before. I can add 5 pounds to what I did the week before. And then you just add 5 pounds for that last set, hit it, back off, come back, and then you can just repeat this cycle for months at a time. And this is when I first started ATG. That's what it was. Like, I was training for 6-8 months, hitting a PR on a lift every time I came in, because we're trying to stimulate, don't annihilate, is a line that Jake Tura uses a lot. It's trying to get that adaptation without crushing them. And I think a lot of weight room stuff is just
the opposite.
Just crush. I mean, a lot of times it's even the sports coach. Like, I've been in weight rooms where the sports coach is like, I want you to crush them today. And it's like, okay, thanks. Like,
dude, I mean, at FIT, we would do, not even in the gym, when we would do, what was it, the 300s or whatever?
Yeah.
They're like, all right, guys, we're going to do sprints that are going to basically kill you 3 days before the game, because this is going to somehow make you mentally tougher, when in reality, we're absolutely fucking your central nervous system and you guys probably won't recover as well as you need to for the game. Retarded.
Yeah, and so that's where using this style, every time I come into the gym, I'm A, fresh, and B, I'm excited to try and beat what I did last week. It makes it like, almost gamifies it a little bit, where you're actually enjoying every time you come into the gym, because you can literally see progress every single day, every single week. Like, it sounds a little bit too good to be true. It's like when you talk about linear periodization, it's like, oh, you top out. That's because a lot of linear periodization is, I'm just going to front squat and I'm going to try and add 5 pounds every week. And if you do that over time, yes, you're going to plateau, because you just won't start. You just can't keep adapting that same way. But when I vary the stimulus so much, when I'm varying the joint angles, when I'm working through full ranges of motion, when I'm training different joints, then it allows me to just keep that stimulus going every time I come back. And it's really, really powerful.
That's sweet, dude. I love all those principles. I think that's something that people could definitely use in season. And all the stuff that they're doing right now in a traditional like strength conditioning should be done like in the off season.
Yeah.
Of when they want to just like get really strong and squat really heavy weights. Like, that's like off season stuff. Like, after you've recovered, you're like, you've got a couple months before preseason starts. Like, that's when that stuff's supposed to be implemented. This stuff is what you should be doing like in season to keep yourself healthy, to bulletproof your knees, your ankles, and to still get stronger. And I love it's because, like you said, the one set at 90% that's going to give you the growth hormone stimulation, all that kind of stuff, it's also going to help you recover. Which I think a lot of people don't realize, that if you do if you do an intense set but you don't absolutely kill yourself, you're going to promote recovery as well. So now that we've talked about principles of training for an athlete, I wanted to dive in a little bit about the nutrition side of athletic development, that just like the entire principles you just talked about that a lot of people, 99% of people out there, neglect. I think a lot of, unless you're a pro, unless your like team has a nutritionist and a dietitian and whatnot, none of this stuff is talked about. I don't remember ever being taught anything about nutrition in college whatsoever. I knew what I knew from bodybuilding.com, which was eat chicken,
T-Nation,
white rice, spinach, and like repeat. That was it. Like, that was all I knew. And the entire time during soccer, I was eating for a bodybuilder. I was eating for a physique when I needed to be eating for performance. So I think when we first talk about this, we need to talk about what type of energy system is this athlete using? What is their sport? I think sprinters, it's 10 seconds. It's extremely fast. We're going in the ATP-only energy system. It's so quick. People that are doing, 400-meter runs, I think a lot of soccer players, CrossFitters out there, they're very glycolytic. You're using carbs primarily for your fuel source. You're doing short sprints, 20 to 30 seconds. You're recovering 20 to 30 seconds. And you're moving constantly all the time versus a marathon runner who's pretty oxidative. They're in the aerobic state a very, very long time. So depending on which one of those you are in with your sport is going to determine a lot of how your macronutrient setup is created. So if you're a soccer player and you are very glycolytic, you're using carbs as a fuel source. Something that nobody really gets into for us is just understanding what destroys your performance. That would be not getting adequate sleep. I know a ton of times before a game, whether we had tests that were coming up, finals, we were up playing video games, we were just nervous and we couldn't go to sleep. Living like very high in a state of cortisol stress is going to not allow you to perform your best during a game. After that, not eating correctly for game day, which I don't think none of us ever really did. Our coaches did. The more I researched this, our coaches did decent.
Yeah.
Better than I thought. Mm. When I first was looking into this, I was like, the coaches didn't do anything right for us. We were not prepared. We're going to Subway. People are getting tuna subs and we're eating gummy bears. And in reality, they did a decent job in making sure that our glycogen stores were topped off with enough food, as long as people did it right. And this was the thing that they never told us. They never told us, hey, when we go to Subway, make sure you're getting the full sub, lean meats, stay away from the fats, and munch on some like quick digesting proteins and carbs before the game. They were just like, eat whatever you want. And you had some players that for some reason didn't want to eat food. You had players that when they did eat food, they went to Subway and they're like, oh, I get a free sub, so let me get like that buffalo chicken or the freaking tuna sub, whichever one's tasty to me. Just slam it in my stomach and now I got a huge stomach full of food, not ready to actually play a game. So we were never educated on the type of foods that we might have needed. Did you have knowledge? Were you prepping food-wise when it came to game day for you?
Back when I was playing, like in college? No, definitely not.
No, yeah. I remember I was at a certain point, I would bring some food from the cafeteria or I would make some food for a certain degree. But also as a goalie, my food was way different than a field player. Like, no, I didn't need to carb load for a game because my amount of movement was 18 yards six times a game versus players who are running for 90 minutes who need to carb load way more than I do. So I think a lot of people in the athletic world, food-wise, don't really think about how to prepare for a game. I think we have a general idea, but it's just like this program. It's just something that they kind of know about. They kind of do a good job about it, but we're never educated on the side of it. And I think a lot of... there's responsibility for players. Like, if you want to get really good, like, there's only so much a coach can do. You only have so much time as a coach to work with the players. Like, you got to do some work on yourself. And hopefully this podcast can give some people some ideas on training to do, different food protocols to follow. But the last part of it is post-game, the recovery. And this one, like, always drives me crazy in that post-game, no matter what, like, without fail, we got Pizza Hut. Like, we got Pizza Hut pizzas, which had a lot of carbs, but it was all carbs and fat. And the fat would slow the insulin response, which would slow our recovery. And if you didn't even play, you just ate half a pizza and you just gained like 3 pounds if you were me for the first 3 years. So it was not well thought out in that space. And I think athletes need to really realize, how can I fuel for this objective? If my sport's glycolytic, I need to carb load. I need to make sure I'm eating adequate amounts of carbs, adequate amount of protein, relatively low fat, and I need to eat maybe a day before, maybe 1 to 3 days before, depending on what the activity is. Just like your training, there's different seasons of your nutrition as well. Going into preseason, I think what a lot of people fail with, and you can tell me if you agree with this or not, preseason, even training-wise, do you think preseason should be, let's kill these guys for a couple, 2 weeks before the season starts?
It's tough for the college route, like the NCAA college route, because preseason's so much shorter. Like, if you look at pros over in like Europe and stuff like that, their preseason's like 6 to 8 weeks long, whereas ours is two to three. So they kind of have no choice. It's as much for like a mental thing as it is for like a physical thing. I definitely think like some coaches take pride in that and they're like, we're just gonna like crush you. Coming back to the nutrition thing, curious, because that's definitely much more your wheelhouse than mine. But for me, the approach that I've been kind of learning about and taking is much more of a almost kind of like ancestral paleo carnivore kind of approach, taken from guys like Charles Poliquin, who would talk about you need to earn your carbs. And by earn your carbs, you need to be sub 10% body fat and you need to be like training like balls to the wall. And that idea that you want to be fat adapted, that you want fat to be your primary daily kind of burning fuel source, and then carbs are like a supplemental thing almost. So I'm kind of curious on your thoughts on that, because when we talk about athletics, we start to talk about like carb loading and things like that, and carbs get thrown around a ton. The idea of being carb dependent versus being fat adapted and having fat be your primary fuel source. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think you can do it. I don't think you can do it for a long period of time. And I don't think it's going to allow you to recover as quickly as you might need to. Fat is turned into an energy source the slowest. So especially if you're doing...
But it is also the most fuel efficient.
That is true, but that's hoping that you are fat adapted and that your body is burning ketones correctly and that you're sticking within the right protocols to allow it to happen. It's very tough to, even keto is very tough to do it correctly. You have to track a lot of your blood glucose levels consistently to make sure you're staying in the right ranges to be burning ketones instead of carbs. So because of that, it's very hard to, like I said, unless you're a pro, if you got somebody helping you out, like, yes, you can do it. But carbohydrates are just such an easier fuel source to modulate, to do it for a larger group of people than going like fat adapted purely. I think it can work in a strength sense. Like if you're working in the gym, your intensity level isn't super high. Like you are doing intense sets, but it's also not for a long duration of time. Versus if you're playing a sport and you're constantly moving for 90 minutes, trying to run solely on fats, I think it's just going to be really difficult.
Yeah, I'm not talking about being solely fat, but like that's what we want our body to default to. Like the reason, like the people that I've been influenced by to talk about this, talk about it more from like an ancestral standpoint of this is what we evolved as our primary fuel source from fish, from meats and that sort of thing. And we evolved on saturated fats and that's what our default is to program. And then carbs came in when we had vegetables, when we had berries and they were a little bit more supplemental and they were kind of like a bonus to us versus now we can go to everywhere you look, you've got carbs kind of to be like shoved in your face. And we run more efficiently off of a primary fat diet, protein fat diet, with carbs being more supplemental.
Yeah, I'd tell you if you looked at most athletes out there, they're using carbs as their fuel source. There's a lot of people now starting to use fats. But even from a recovery sense, carbohydrates can spike your insulin like instantly to get you out of a sympathetic state. So if you were doing whatever sport, you're in a prolonged period of cortisol being elevated. And as soon as the game is over and the clock stops, your body doesn't know. Your body has no idea that the clock stopped. Your body is still thinking we're in an elevated state. We're in that sympathetic nervous system. And the quickest way for us to get out of the sympathetic nervous system into the parasympathetic is to introduce fast-acting carbs that are going to spike insulin, which is going to reduce cortisol.
Right, and that's when I think like post-game and stuff like that, that's like prime time for stuff like that. I'm not talking about going no carb or anything like that, especially if like you're a soccer player, but maybe having, pushing your carbs to post-training to in the evening when we've had our high-fat, high-protein, egg, sausage, that sort of thing in the morning to kick off that sort of energy system. And then we use those later on to recover, to replenish, that sort of thing, rather than having carbs, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Correct. No, yeah, I would agree with that. I would say that if your game, whatever you're doing, is at night, like you said, you can start your day high protein, high fat, because you can, if you've already eaten correctly throughout the day, it's like your glycogen stores are probably topped off.
Yeah.
You're probably good. As long as you've eaten adequately and you're not been in a calorie deficit for a long period of time. And so if your game was later at night, you wanted to have your first meal 1 to 3 hours before the game, and that had starchy carbs in it, that was going to top you off a little bit. Post-game, you had quick ones. Afterwards, decent meal, like stuff like that. If you did it that way, 100% I agree with you. I don't think you need to go every single meal being carbohydrates.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't even do that. When we played games, I never did that. In the morning, it was high protein, high fat. Before the game and after the game was when I would have my carbs. Just because it's going to help fuel you the most and it's going to get you the mix. The second most important thing after your performance is your recovery.
Yep.
Because you are only as good as quick as you can recover. If you can do it once, amazing. But if you do it once and it takes you weeks to recover versus somebody who does it once and they recover the next day, they're just going to beat you.
Yeah. And that's where I do agree. I think like carbs are super important because of that insulin spike. But then because of that insulin spike, I'm also very wary about introducing them periodically throughout the day. Just because you get on that roller coaster of spike your insulin, crash your insulin, spike your insulin, crash your insulin. And then we become very insulin resistant. You see that in the majority of the population today are very struggle with insulin sensitivity and that sort of thing. So I'm just very cognizant of that. In turn, from an athlete and even from like a gen pop setting.
Yeah. I mean, I would say if you if everything in you is working correctly, you shouldn't have insulin sensitivity.
Yeah.
You should be able to handle insulin spikes.
And I think if everything's working correctly, I would say you would default to more of a fat adapted approach. That's something that's when you're talking about, it's a lot more fuel efficient. It's a lot more slow burning. And it's, we have way, way more. We have the capacity to store 100 times more fat than we do carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is something that we have to continually replenish. So when you're just talking about like a default source of fuel, for me, it's more of a fat approach. And then carbs, you can, are the extra when I really have to compete, when I really have to push. So from an athletic standpoint, of course, they're important. Just being careful of when they get introduced, how often they get introduced, how much, like that sort of thing. Like I basically, it all comes back to Charles Poliquin, like earn your carbs.
I don't know how I feel about earn your carbs. I think earn your carbs kind of like, I understand it. I think for a lot of people, if they just understood their calories and they understood not overeating, even if they did have carbs throughout the day, if it made them feel better, if that's just how their body was fueled, because everyone's different. Some people are honestly fueled better off fats. Some people are fueled better off carbs. And if they can do it throughout the day, they keep them at regularly like good levels and they don't overeat, they're probably going to perform relatively well. So I don't know. Earn your carbs. I used to like, that used to be my thing too. It was like, unless I work really, really hard, like I'm gonna like stay away from the carbs. But if I did that, I just ended up restricting myself and I would probably undereat most of the time, is because it was like, all right, like earn your carbs. And I'm like, oh, did I really work that hard today? Like, and then now I'm telling myself like, nah, you probably didn't. When in reality, like, were you stressed today? Did you have a lot of shit going on besides the workout? Because if you're overly stressed from outside environmental like aspects, like that's something to take into consideration as well. And carbohydrates can help curb some of that stress. But I'm just going back and forth with you, honestly.
No, for
it,
sure.
it could honestly go either way. It's dependent on the person. And especially like,
yeah, I'm just curious about it.
Yeah. I think if you're,
cause I see both sides, like I'm just wary of that, like insulin ping pong game. But then it's also something that we function very well, that we definitely need from a performance standpoint.
Yeah, because you also have to think throughout the day, even if your insulin did spike a couple times, so let's say breakfast it spiked, lunch it spiked, dinner it spiked. After you digest the food and you go out of that insulin spike and you go technically into a fasted state for a little bit of time before your next meal, you're burning some calories. You get another insulin spike, you store some food. You burn some calories a little bit in the fasted state. You do it one more time. And then you go to sleep for 8 hours. And in that 8 hours, you're in a fasted state. And your body's burning fat throughout that time. So as long as you're burning correctly and everything, you have like a homeostatic balance within you internally, even if you had those small insulin spikes, you're going to have such a that long period of the fasted state that if everything's working, you should be burning the fat anyways to where you'd be okay.
That is what I'm talking about. Making sure we're at the point where in these fasting states, fats are what's being burned versus mm-hmm. being carbohydrate dependent. And then we run out of stores and you have no energy and that sort of thing. So I'm just talking about trying to get us to the point where we need to make sure that fat is what's being burned when I fast. I'm also a huge fan of intermittent fasting and just
yeah,
fasting.
Honestly, like people in college, like if you ate at 2 a.m. and then you ate at like 8 a.m. and then you ate like again and again and again, like a lot of people we knew did, like you're going to probably fuck up your insulin sensitivity and that's on you. And you have to understand that and you have to do the work to fix it. But if you're an athlete trying to focus on your performance, like you said, just understanding how much you intake, understanding what your macros are is especially important. Are you fat adapted? Do you run better off fats or do you run better off carbs? What's your protein intake like? A lot of people's is very low.
Oh, it's always low.
Because like, let's also talk about the fact that once you start burning, especially if you're glycolytic, once you burn your carbs, if you're in a sport, your body's going to burn protein next before it goes to fat. Because protein breaks down faster than fat. So even if you are only eating fats, if you're in a glycolytic sport and you run out of your glycogen source, you burn your carbs, your body's gonna go, okay, I do need to burn something for energy, but fat takes a really long time and Zach's sprinting right now. So what do? I'm gonna start breaking down some of his protein in his body to give us energy that's gonna happen faster than breaking down fat. So that's why you see after a game, a match, anything like that, people are going to need a huge, like a dose of a 1-to-2 ratio of protein and carbs. You also want to replenish the protein because your body probably, for a lot of players out there, broke down some muscle to give them energy throughout there, especially if you're going into overtime, stuff like that. You see people pulling hamstrings, getting injured, stuff like that, because their body is trying to pull something for energy So that's why I think carbs are also a good point for something that's glycolytic.
Yep.
Just because it's going to take a little bit of time to burn the fat. Cool. So that's in season. So even talking about with your athletic principles, how I think strength conditioning should be going on during their off season. Nutrition for athletes has different protocols for in season. For in season, we're only focused on performance and recovery. This is when carbs would be important. So this is what I'm trying to do, explain a different, the periodization of food. So carbs are very important in season. We need recovery. Honestly, you don't need abs. Like guys that, like Tom Brady won the Super Bowl, I don't even know how many times. That guy's never had abs. Like being lean doesn't mean like adequate performance for everybody. Sometimes you need fat stores. That's going to promote recovery. That's going to promote hormone production. So in season, we need to focus on recovery, which is going to be protein, carbs, relatively low fat, at least for my point of view. Post-season is when we would do a lot of the stuff you're talking about. Carbohydrates come down because stress is already lower. We're in a focus on recovery. Fats are going to go up to get us back to a normal hormonal number, because usually if you're in a huge season, very stressful, hormone production goes down. So we want to be able to get you back to homeostasis. That's a time when we would ramp up fats, lower carbs, do something potentially like carnivore to get them back into a homeostatic state where they feel good. Once we get out of off season, we go into preseason. Hopefully then we're starting to ramp down volume. We're starting to increase carbohydrates to get their glycogen stores back up. And then we go through the season all over again.
This idea of periodization is something that I'm very kind of interested in from a nutrition perspective, but also from a strength and conditioning perspective. We talk about changing the way we do things from off season to in season to preseason and that sort of thing. And the idea is we want to like peak, right? Like we want to prepare, and then put ourselves in an optimal state to perform. My issue with that is for like college sports and that sort of thing, or even pro sports more so. So let's look at the NBA. Like the NBA is an 82 game regular season plus then postseason. Like for me, like how do you peak for that? Like you can't. Like what are you going to say, we're going to peak for the end of the season and then just sacrifice the beginning? And it's like as prep work. Like for me, periodization came about for Olympic sports. You have 4 years to prepare. We want to structure that. So in 4 years' time, I'm going to have one competition. I need to be at my absolute best. Versus we've taken those principles and applied it to like a Major League Baseball season. Like I don't even know how many games those guys play, like 100 or something like that. It's ridiculous. Like to me, you can't peak for something like that without sacrificing somewhere along the way. For me, I think about it much more as a like state of readiness, like just being like constantly on. Like you think about like guys like Kobe, guys like Michael Jordan, they were literally training on game days. Like they were lifting on game days. Like Kobe's on record is like talking about how it's an 82 game season. Like if you sacrifice 82 days out of a 365 day training cycle, like that's a quarter of your year almost. And this is something that I think Ben has kind of instilled in me when he actually played basketball at Eastern Florida. And when he played there, he did his own kind of style of training. And he was the only player that in season, from beginning of season to end of season, his vertical went up. Like most of the time, like you see performance like tank and that sort of thing, and you're just trying to maintain. Literally from the beginning of basketball season to the end of a season, he increased his vertical despite being in season in like the most stressful times. And I think finding a way to balance that, like finding a way to have this sort of constant readiness rather than this roller coaster of prepare, perform, recover, prepare, perform, recover, I think is much more stable. And when we talk about long-term performance, when we talk about typical pro sports as we think about it, where we have these long drawn out seasons, I just don't see how you can peak from a strength and conditioning or even like a nutrition perspective for me. I think it's kind of like the same thing. So I'm curious on your thoughts on peaking, periodization in general from whichever standpoint you want to look at.
Yeah, I think I'm a big fan of periodization. I think it's very important for people to, I understand the concept of always being on, but you can't always be on. If you're like if you leave the lights on for long enough, like eventually it's going to burn out.
So that's if you're pushing the limits. Like,
correct.
Because again, for me, I go back to like ancestral, like kind of like what we've been doing for like 2,000 years. Like,
well, you got to think of ancestral. There was periodization in the ancestral times. There was times when they had food and they could eat and they could harvest. And there's times when they couldn't eat. They had to become fat adapted. They had to go long periods of time without food until they could eat again.
That's a good point.
Which was a cyclical cycle.
I'm just thinking tiger's tiger, whether it's May or whether it's June or whether it's December. Like, there's a certain point that, like, and of course that's a much more short term like example, but there's a certain point of not having like days off kind of thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you just have to define what a day off is. So you can even look at Michael Jordan when he trained like crazy. If you watched his documentary The Last Dance, there was times when he went out and played golf. And for him, going out to play golf is a time when he gets to go from a sympathetic nervous system into parasympathetic, where he gets to fully relax. He's just out on the golf course. Like, yeah, he's making a couple side bets, but like he's smoking a cigar. Like, that might not be the best for his health, but also it just gets him into a relaxed state.
Yeah.
So it allows him to recover. So even if it's a long sport, if you were in a long 82 games, like you said, even postseason, 100 games, really, really long time, you're going to have to, he's an athlete. It's not going to be perfect. You're going to have to figure out in season your whole goal, performance, recovery. What does that mean? How much food can you get to make him recover? How much sleep does he need? He trains a lot too, so you got to be able to time it correctly. You got to be able to work with him to get the right program. Whenever the season's over, you only have X amount of time before he goes back. And he's Michael Jordan, so he's training like a fiend. You just have to know the person. If you know the person, how can I introduce as many parasympathetic activities in his off season and increase calories to get his body? Because if you're playing that long, you're burning so many calories. You're burning so much fuel. You don't want to lose muscle mass. So we need to, at some point, get him in a surplus. It doesn't work in season because putting him in a surplus might make him feel heavy on the court, but he might burn it and it might be a good thing to keep him at maintenance. It would be very person-to-person dependent, figuring out what their cycle is. Because like you said, if you have an Olympic athlete, you have 4 years, you can really string it out and it can be really, really nice. If you've got NBA players, it's very short and you have to figure out what can I do in that amount of time to get them to recover as much as possible, to get their stress levels down, to get their hormone levels back up so they can do the exact same thing, if not better, next year. So every person is going to be different. Freaking Dennis Rodman, he needed to go to Las Vegas and bet and hang out with strippers and do WWE fights. Like, that was his way of chilling. Michael Jordan wanted to go play golf. Whatever thing was going to work for you the most to recover is going to be the most important. So I do think like being ready is important, but especially for an athlete, like you got to be able to turn it off. I think there's a lot of power in being able to turn off the mind, being able to just be like, yes, I've worked really hard, but I also recover really hard.
No, and I definitely like that. I like that you come at it from the sympathetic, parasympathetic, like, cause I don't think we think about that enough. And I'm definitely not saying like you need to just be, you don't need to unwind or something like that. I'm just saying I don't like the idea of either like trying to sacrificing some part of the season, whatever it is. Like if we think about it from like a Premier League perspective where there are no playoffs, like game one is as important as game 38.
I don't even know.
I think it's 38. And so that idea of absolutely when we're playing games, like do we need to prep, perform, recover, prep, perform, recover? I just don't like this idea of when we talk about periodization, that's kind of what we think of. Like we've got our GPP phase, we've got our peaking phase, we've got XYZ. And then to me, somewhere along the way, like either we're peaked for the first 2 weeks of the season. That's how most of the time it's set up. Like you're going to peak just in time for the season to start. And then we're just going to try and ride that out for the rest of the season. Like for something like NFL, where you've got 16 games once a week, like maybe that works a little bit better. For something like when we talk about the NBA, like I don't.
Yeah,
I'm skeptical of that idea of how can you ride that out for 4 or 5 months at a time.
Yeah, in that sense, you need to get away from, I guess, the traditional idea of what periodization is and think of it as whatever sport it is, whichever duration their season is, that whole season we want to peak.
Yeah.
So in order to peak for that entire season, what do we have to do nutrition-wise to allow them to stay at a peak level?
But it's hard to, you can't really think of 4 months as a peak. Like that's a, by definition, it's a plateau.
Well, you're keeping them at their peak level. Like, yes. There's going to be some drop off, but you want to minimize the drop off as much as possible, which is just giving them enough food to recover. whenever that season ends for whichever league or however duration is, whatever their off season is, that's the time you get, whether it's a really long time or a really short period of time. How am I going to get them back to healthy is the only goal you can really focus on. And once you get them back into preseason, you kind of start the whole process over, but it's very individualized. And like you said, it could go all the way to, and on an NBA team, I don't even know how many players there are, 12, 15?
Yeah, not a lot.
Each one of them could have a completely different nutrition prescription to allow them to perform and recover at their best.
I think for me, just if you think about that drawn out over time, and especially like if you add in like Olympics or whatever it is, like the amount of, and you can even think about this from like youth level athletes, how like there really is no off season for kids anymore. And like they're just playing everything year round from a professional perspective. It's pretty close to year round somewhere along the way. So especially like on the professional side of things, I feel like we lose the trying to get better. You know what I mean? Like it's just, we're trying to prep for the season, survive the season, recover from the season. Prep for the season, survive the season, recover from the season. We're never in this state of, all right, I'm trying to improve. And that's when I think, when I'm citing guys like Kobe and like Jordan, I think that's the approach that they took, that every game matters. They're trying to compete. They're trying to be at their best for every game. But their training and the way they approach the game is set up so that every game, every week, every season, they're trying to come back in an even better level. And of course, that's what happens at pro sports. It's just, I don't know if it's just the language, but something about it to me, it just seems like we're in more of a defensive, like survival state mindset, rather than trying to like be positive, try and actually create growth, create adaptation, create improvement throughout the course of a season. Like for me, I don't see why, from whatever level you're at, why you can't try and get better from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, I guess is what I'm looking at.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think you can even fuel that to have that thing happen. When I say the most important thing is performance and recovery, I don't mean like just maintain performance and recovery. You can overly fuel if they're doing the extra work to allow them to progress to make the gains they want. You probably have to. If somebody's working as hard as Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant did, I bet you they ate a lot of food. Michael Phelps ate a shit ton of food.
Oh my God, yeah, I remember that.
Because he was doing so much work that he had to fuel that. Because if you don't, you're going to start overworking yourself. You're going to start breaking down proteins. You're going to start actually ruining your performance. So if you do want to go down that route, I think one, you got to be a freak. I think two, like you got to have like the burning desire to actually do it. But if you do want to do it, like you got to fuel that yourself for that.
Oh, for sure.
You have to put yourself potentially in a surplus. Because you're going to be burning so much fuel, you want to make sure that you don't lose muscle over the season. You want to maintain the muscle, so you have to overeat. So I think we're on the same page. It's just making sure that I agree. Like, I think you can get better throughout the season. I think you should. I think you can. But you have to fuel yourself correctly for that. Yeah, I think a lot of people out there don't even know what fueling themselves actually means. They wake up, they eat some food, they eat lunch, they eat whatever. They go to the cafeteria, and they eat whatever they want, like pasta, full of fat, like all the sauces, like all the breads, like overstuff themselves and think that that's how they're going to perform their best. When you can, like you said, you can be very mindful of both these aspects, training and nutrition. They're both going to catapult you at a level above most other people, because everyone else only knows work really hard. And like work really hard only works to a certain point. I guarantee you the Kobe's, the Michael Jordan's out there, like they had other coaches in this aspect that were helping them in all areas of their performance to improve. So I think we're on the same pitch.
100%.
Cool. So I think that's all we got. All right. I think we've actually covered completely anyone out there who's trying to figure out how to improve their athletic performance. We've pretty much gone over the gambit. I mean, you have to... I think the stuff that Zach talked about with these principles of training can really transform anybody. Like he said, even in season, you just have to want it. Like you actually just have to do the work to start understanding these principles, to actually start putting them in practice and drop your fucking ego at the door and actually start where you need to start to make the gains. If you want to be able to fuel this correctly, you need to start understanding what your food actually looks like. Is it actually fueling you? Or is it not? Are you eating enough to recover from your workouts? Are you eating enough to perform at your highest or not? And if you're not, you can train as hard as you want. You're just going to get burned out. So anyone out there that's listening, I think this was a very informative podcast on both sides. Zach, do you have anything else to add?
Not really, man. No, I think we've covered, like you said, we went really deep. So, I mean, if anyone's looking for more of this stuff, like how to actually put it into practice and take it from paper to something real, like reach out to either of us, reach out to me if you're interested in the actual like physical training sort of things, just because I'm just trying to talk about this, spread this sort of thing as much as I can, just because I think it's should be more widespread than it is. Like, I don't think we're doing enough as an industry. And my goal is really just to kind of help people that are willing to do the work and have somewhere they want to go. Like, I just want to give them the tools that they need to make it somewhere.
I would completely second that. And I would say the exact same thing. I think nutrition for the widespread athletics out there is rarely talked about unless you're very high up in the game. And for a lot of you out there, it could be one of the missing links. I can guarantee you, if I knew what my nutrition should have been in college, I would have been a better athlete, like hands 100%. Down. Like, if you would have known those athletic principles, like,
oh man,
like it's not even funny. So anyone out there who's thinking like, I can't do it, I don't know the tools, like honestly, like Zach said, reach out to us. I will tell you, if you want the athletic stuff or the training, ask Zach. He knows more of it than I am. I'm learning about this stuff, but nutrition side, if you want to go deep on that, you hit me up and I'll have a conversation with you for 2 to 3 hours because that's my jam. So I appreciate you guys listening to another episode of the It's All Day podcast, and we will talk with you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to the It's All Day podcast on the 1513 Network. I'd love to connect with you guys. You can find me on Instagram at @_ChrisPage_coach. And you can listen to this on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google.